Hundreds more soldiers are being deployed in parts of eastern Spain, left devastated by flash flooding. A jealous teenage boy who killed his former girlfriend in a frenzied knife attack is to spend at least 17 years behind bars. GPs have warned that practices will be forced to close if they aren't exempted from paying higher national insurance for their staff. The vaccination of children in northern Gaza against polio is to resume in the morning after being disrupted by Israeli military operations. A lawyer for women who say they were sexually abused by Mohammed El-Fayed is calling for a public inquiry into the way allegations were dealt with. Also tonight, the most exciting young coach in Europe, Manchester United's verdict on their new manager, Pedro Almeyrin. More than 200 people are now known to have died in flash floods in eastern Spain. Dozens of people remain unaccounted for in and around the city of Valencia, where rapidly rising waters left many trapped in their houses, vehicles and workplaces on Tuesday night. In many areas, roads are still inaccessible and mobile phone networks and landlines are down, while hundreds of thousands of people are without mains water and power. Another 500 soldiers are being deployed to add to the 1,700 troops already helping rescuers. A severe weather alert for torrential rain is still in place on the southern coast around Huelva, where hundreds of families were evacuated from their homes. Our Europe correspondent Bethany Bell reports from Valencia.
Streets in parts of the city and many surrounding towns bear the scars of the devastation brought by torrential rain on Tuesday night. Mud caked on roads, pavements and buildings, overturned cars littering the streets. The entrance to one road tunnel here is completely blocked, with four rows of cars piled on top of each other. With many people still missing, there's a strong sense of shock and anger. In the village of Aldaya, we met Juan González, who's an English teacher. He told us the local authorities had failed his community.
It's a mix of anger and sadness. Sadness because obviously all these, you know, people that are not here have gone through a terrible agony to until they died. They passed away. And anger because it's a rage is that our local government didn't do anything about it, knowing they well knew that, you know, this was coming and did nothing about it.
Volunteers out in force, battling the mud with brooms and spades. Some have walked long distances across roads blocked to cars to try to help with the clean-up. Valencia's regional president, Carlos Mazón, said more troops would be deployed.
We have requested additional army troops for tomorrow. They've been on the move since 8 o'clock today, and tomorrow, in principle, there will be another 500. As we continue assessing the situation, the needs are being integrated to give the army the task, the work, and the needs to be handled.
Outside food distribution centres, people are queuing up for supplies. Monica, a volunteer, said she felt compelled to come and help.
I came here to help anything they could need, cleaning, coming with the supplies, water, clothes, oil, anything that they can need. All the cleaning supplies also, baths, shower, everything. I need to come and help them. They need everything.
Many people here are worried for their family and friends. One local mayor warned that many of the upturned vehicles on the streets could have people trapped inside them.
At least 14 people have been killed in Serbia after a glass and concrete canopy collapsed at a railway station. Cranes and bulldozers were brought in to move wreckage as part of the search for survivors in Novi Sad, 40 miles from the capital Belgrade. Officials say the rescue operation has now ended. The Prime Minister, Miloš Vučević, has described what happened as a black day for the whole of Serbia. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay reports.
It was dark by the time emergency teams finished searching the rubble in front of Novi Sad railway station. They'd been working since around midday when the concrete canopy above the building entrance collapsed on the people below. Authorities say that most of those hit by the debris died instantly. Those who survived face life-changing injuries. The government has declared Saturday to be a day of mourning, but the recriminations have already started. President Alexander Vučić said he wanted those responsible to be prosecuted and severely punished. Opposition politicians suspect shoddy construction work on one of the government's flagship infrastructure projects. The station officially opened in July after years of reconstruction, but the canopy which collapsed wasn't included in the renovation.
A teenage boy who stalked and killed his 15-year-old ex-girlfriend has been detained for at least 17 years. Logan McPhail, who was then aged 16, followed Holly Newton before stabbing her to death in an alleyway in Hexham in Northumberland last year. Her mother, Michaela Trussler, said McPhail had once warned that if he couldn't have her daughter, then nobody could. Alison Freeman was at Newcastle Crown Court. Some listeners may find details of her report distressing.
He's been too horrible to me, and last night was that he meant to kill myself.
The body-worn camera of the police officer who arrested Logan McPhail recorded him saying that Holly Newton had been horrible to him and that he planned to hurt himself, not her. But during sentencing, the judge, Sir Nicholas Hilliard KC, said McPhail had lied repeatedly and had stabbed his ex-girlfriend to death because of resentment and jealousy. McPhail had stalked the teenage girl around Hexham for almost an hour in January last year, his face covered. He inflicted 36 stab and slash wounds on Holly Newton in just 1 minute. The attack was so brutal, the knife broke.
In addition, Holly was a child. Although you were not an adult, she was no match for you, armed with a knife. She had severe injuries as she sought to defend herself from the knife. She must have realised before she died, I'm afraid, that she was fighting for her life.
McPhail had also turned up outside the family home the night before he killed Holly Newton and waited for hours in the cold, begging a sibling to let him in. But the teenager's mum, Michaela Trussler, said she was relieved they had refused.
I think if he'd somehow managed to get into the house, then could have been a whole different story, but we could have been looking at maybe more than one murder.
Logan McPhail was jailed for 17 years, but the judge said no sentence could undo what he had done.
Six teenagers are being held on suspicion of attempted murder after the stabbing of a 13-year-old girl in East Yorkshire. She's in a critical condition in hospital after the attack at Hesel near Hull. The police believe she was known to her attackers, but say they're working to establish the exact circumstances of what happened. Paul Murphy sent this report from close to the scene.
The 13-year-old girl was first spotted in the dim light of this morning's rush hour at the side of the busy A63 dual carriageway. She'd suffered what Humberside police describe as life-threatening injuries to her neck, chest, abdomen and back. Members of the public tried to help her. Six teenagers, four boys aged 14, 15, 16 and 17, and two girls aged 14 and 15, were arrested shortly afterwards in a nearby woodland on suspicion of attempted murder. The police are appealing for any dash cam footage that may have been recorded close to the scene.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is facing demands to exempt GP surgeries, pharmacies and charities from the rise in employers' national insurance contributions announced in the budget. Family doctors have warned they'll have to make redundancies and close practices if they aren't reimbursed for the increased payments. Ms Reeves has defended the measure, with the NHS due to receive a funding boost of more than £22 billion. Our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus reports.
In a letter to the Health Secretary, the chairwoman of the Royal College of GPs, Professor Carmela Hawthorne, said she was seeking urgent assurances that GP practices would be protected from the impact of the increase in employer national insurance. She called for extra money for GPs to cover the costs, saying practices across the country were already struggling because of chronic, historic underfunding. Dr. Ahmed Amar from the Wilmslow Health Centre in Cheshire said the imposition of this tax had shocked GPs.
There's lots of anger. We've got Wes Streeting saying that he wants to bring the family doctor back. And in one fell swoop yesterday, they're putting practices at risk. We're talking about redundancies, we're talking about practice closures. This really is very serious, and it just hasn't been thought out properly.
Those concerns, Downing Street has suggested, may be addressed in the coming weeks. A Number 10 spokesperson said GPs were not eligible for an exemption from the tax rises, but the issue could be dealt with in the annual GP contract process, where funding for family doctors is confirmed. It will take place later this year. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said difficult decisions had had to be made, but the money going to the NHS would deliver real change.
Well, the NHS budget has increased by £22.6 billion, and the NHS needs now to live within that budget. But it is the most generous settlement for a decade and a half outside of COVID for the National Health Service. And the NHS have confirmed that within that, they will be able to deliver the 40,000 additional appointments every single week to bring those waiting lists down.
Meanwhile, charities and voluntary organisations are also calling on the government to help them offset the rise in the tax. Many, including Shelter, Crisis and Age UK, have signed an open letter to the Chancellor saying they are already in a dire situation, seeing rising need as public services are failing, while they face escalating costs and declines in their funding. They warn many organisations may be forced to reduce staff, cut salaries and scale back services, which they say would hurt the very people they strive to support.
Lebanon's Ministry of Health says 52 people have been killed and more than 70 others wounded in the latest Israeli strikes. The statement said the Israeli army had not issued evacuation warnings before the attacks carried out in quick succession in a region northeast of Beirut. Separately, the United States has announced it's deploying additional military assets to the Middle East, including ballistic missile defense destroyers and the long-range B-52 bomber aircraft. A Pentagon spokesman said the US would defend its people should Iran or its partners and proxies target American personnel or interests in the region. The World Health Organization says the second round of a polio vaccination program will resume for children in northern Gaza in the morning. It had been suspended because of Israel's military offensive against Hamas in the area. The leaders of 15 UN agencies and humanitarian organizations have described conditions there as apocalyptic and warned that around 400,000 people were at imminent risk of death. Our Middle East regional editor Sebastian Usher reports from Jerusalem on efforts to protect children from the crippling polio virus.
The first round of vaccinations of more than 500,000 children in Gaza went relatively smoothly back in September. In order to build up immunity, a second round has now taken place in central and southern Gaza, where UN aid agencies say some 440,000 children have been vaccinated. But the third and final phase of the second rollout had to be postponed in the north when the situation became once again too dangerous, with Israel starting a major air and ground assault against remnants of Hamas several weeks ago. Now, UN aid agencies say they've had assurances that a humanitarian pause in Gaza City will allow them to resume there. But the WHO says that around 15,000 children under 10 are still inaccessible in towns further north, where Israel's offensive has been most intense. In the centre of Gaza, Palestinian medical officials say 14 people were killed in an Israeli strike that hit the gate of a school in Nusayret, where displaced people were sheltering.
The Israeli military says it's killed a senior Hamas official in an airstrike in southern Gaza. It says Izzaldin Kassib was a member of the organization's political leadership and had directed attacks against Israel. Hamas has issued a statement mourning his death. With 4 days to go until the US presidential election, a record number of people have already cast their ballots in early voting. Both Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are campaigning in the swing state of Wisconsin. Our correspondent in Washington, Will Grant, considers how the race is shaping up in its last few days.
Are we ready to vote?
As the candidates head into their final weekend of campaigning before Tuesday's vote, anyone looking to the polls for a definitive answer on how this race will turn out are likely to be disappointed. When Vice President Kamala Harris took over from President Joe Biden at the top of the Democratic Party's ticket in July, she enjoyed an initial surge which counteracted Mr. Biden's low popularity rating among the electorate. However, since then, most polls have consistently shown this will be a very tight race. The BBC's US partner, CBS, has Vice President Harris exactly neck and neck with Donald Trump, particularly in the seven crucial swing states. Where either candidate does enjoy a small advantage, the lead is well within the margin of error. While the outcome of this vote could prove just as close, given the United States Electoral College system, a few thousand votes could be enough to turn a state one way or the other. As such, either a clear Harris win or a clear Trump victory are also distinctly plausible scenarios. Alan Leichman, professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., says what is apparent from the polling is that the two have significant leads among different groups of voters.
This is an election with probably the greatest gender divide we've ever seen. And in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina, early votes are very heavily tilted towards women. And if that continues, that's very positive for Harris.
That said, Donald Trump has a strong lead among young men. The issues motivating voters to cast their ballots are also clear, with the economy, immigration, crime and abortion all featuring highly. Still, this looks set to be one of the closest US elections in living memory, and the campaigns are bracing themselves for the possibility of a long legal battle over the final result.
North Korea has vowed to stand by Russia until it secures victory in Ukraine. The country's foreign minister, Choi Son-hui, was speaking during a visit to Moscow. The United States has warned thousands of North Korean troops are preparing to enter the conflict on Russia's side. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Kyiv.
According to US intelligence, up to 10,000 North Korean troops are training in Russia, with some having already made their way to the Kursk region which borders Ukraine. President Zelensky has criticised his Western allies for failing to stop this deepening cooperation between Moscow and Pyongyang, and again urged them to allow his military to use Western missiles on targets deep inside Russia. Dr. Evelyn Farkas is a former US National Security Advisor and, on a visit to Kyiv, said the deployment of North Korean troops would be geopolitically significant.
What is alarming is that it demonstrates a deeper military cooperation between Russia and North Korea, and the likelihood that the deal involves giving advanced technology to North Korea in order to improve their nuclear weapons program.
While the Kremlin has praised what it called Pyongyang's principled stance on Ukraine, South Korea is far less impressed, with it considering whether to send lethal aid, including artillery shells, to Ukraine for the first time. Supplies Kyiv continues to desperately need.
A lawyer representing women who say they were sexually assaulted by Mohammed El-Fayed has called for a public inquiry into the handling of allegations against the businessman. The BBC has revealed that the former owner of Harrods was reported to the Metropolitan Police a decade earlier than the force previously acknowledged. Here's our investigations correspondent, Daniel De Simone.
Samantha Ramsey was 17 when she reported Mohammed El-Fayed to the Met in 1995 for sexually assaulting her in Harrods. She has since died, but her family have told the BBC how the force dismissed her report. They believe multiple women could have been saved from sexual abuse if the police had acted. Since a BBC film in September exposed allegations of rape and abuse by El-Fayed, the Met has accepted that 21 women reported him from 2005 until his death. But Samantha's report was a decade before, meaning officers knew about him much earlier. Emma Jones, who represents the Ramsey family and victims of El-Fayed, says a public inquiry is needed to examine how various institutions handled claims against him.
So the purpose of a public inquiry will be to shine a light into all the dark and dirty corners of the Met Police, of their systems, of the culture.
The revelation about Samantha's case raises questions about whether Scotland Yard has acknowledged or is aware of the full number of reports it received from victims and admitted the extent of its failure to investigate them. The Met says there's no history of Samantha's case on its computer systems, but that paper-based reports from the 1990s might not have been digitised. It said it acknowledged that trust and confidence was affected by its approach in the past, and it was determined to do better.
The Crown Prosecution Service is deciding whether to bring charges against the MP Mike Amesbury after a video appearing to show him punch a man to the ground was published. Cheshire Police has passed a file about the incident to prosecutors after interviewing the member for Runcorn and Helsby under caution. Mr Amesbury was suspended by the Labour Party last weekend. A jury has seen footage of the moment Sara Sharif's father, stepmother and uncle were arrested on suspicion of her murder just minutes after their plane landed in London. The trio were returning from Pakistan, where they had travelled the day after the 10-year-old died. Her body was later discovered in a bunk bed at the family home in Woking in Surrey. All three defendants deny murder and causing or allowing the death of a child. Our correspondent Helena Wilkinson was at the Old Bailey.
In September last year, police received information that the three defendants would be arriving at Gatwick Airport on an Emirates flight from Dubai. Within 7 minutes of the plane touching down, officers were on board, ready to arrest them. The jury was shown footage from the officers' body cams. As they made their way down the aisle past passengers in their seats, Sara Sharif's stepmother, Beenish Batool, raised her hand and said, "I think you're looking for us."
"We are, yes."
Sara's father, Irfan, was handcuffed on the plane. The trio were then taken off the aircraft. Mr Sharif was then formally arrested.
"From the injuries sustained by her and the investigation conducted, you are suspected of her murder. You are therefore arrested for murder of Sara Sharif."
Sara's uncle, Faisal Malik, and her stepmother, Beenish Batool, were also arrested on suspicion of murder. In interviews with police the following day, they made no comment to questions asked by officers. The trial continues.
NVIDIA, the US semiconductor designer whose products play a central role in artificial intelligence, is to join the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Its inclusion marks a changing of the guard in the tech sector. NVIDIA will replace Intel, whose own processors powered the boom in personal computers. Intel has been on the Dow since 1999, but is the worst performer this year of the 30 companies listed on the index. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones closed up 289 points at 42,052. In the City, the 100 share index ended the day up 67 points at 8,177. On the currency markets, the pound is trading at $1.29.3 against the euro. Sterling is at €1.19.3, making a euro worth 83.8 pence. Manchester United have appointed Ruben Amorim as their new head coach. They've agreed to pay the Portuguese champions Sporting Lisbon more than £9 million to secure the 39-year-old, who's never managed outside his home country. He replaces Erik ten Hag, who was sacked on Monday. Here's Hugh Ferris.
Manchester United are starting a new era. After days of speculation, the club confirmed Ruben Amorim would move to Old Trafford on the 11th of November, with their statement calling him one of the most exciting and highly rated young coaches in European football. His deal runs until June 2027, with an option to extend for another year, which is when the minority owners Ineos have set him the target of making United Premier League champions again. Six United managers have tried and failed to claim a 21st English League title in the decade since Sir Alex Ferguson left, with the current team sitting only 14th in the table. These fans outside Old Trafford hope the new boss can turn the tide.
A little nervous, could be exciting. From what we've seen in the past, it's got to be good news.
I think he's good. I've seen him manage Sporting Lisbon, and they haven't lost a game since August 3rd, so I think he'll do well for United.
I don't know. I really don't. I'm kind of in two minds.
I wish him the best of luck. He has a good record in Portugal in Lisbon. We'll see how it goes. I hope he does well. He's young and enthusiastic.
Three Sporting matches remain for Amorim before he joins United, including next week in the Champions League against Manchester City, where he had been tipped to take over in the event of Pep Guardiola's departure. After that, the 39-year-old will become one of the youngest men to lead Manchester United since Sir Matt Busby. It's the history that era kickstarted that has weighed heavily on Amorim's immediate predecessors and makes his job all the more challenging.
The Welsh Rugby Union is to apologise for the way it handled contract talks with the senior women's team after reports players were rushed into signing deals. It's denied fresh allegations of sexism. The WRU's chair, Richard Collier-Keywood, has acknowledged there's a long road ahead to improvement. A review of the contract negotiation process is expected to publish its recommendations later this month. Our Wales correspondent Thomas Morgan has the details.
This latest row comes on the back of last year's damning independent review, which found aspects of the Welsh Rugby Union's culture were sexist, misogynistic, racist and homophobic, and not properly challenged. Contract talks between the WRU and its female players had been taking place, the third set of negotiations in 3 years. It's been claimed players were given a three-hour ultimatum to sign contracts and threatened with withdrawal from next year's Rugby World Cup. In a hastily arranged news conference this afternoon, the union denied any allegations of sexism, but Alison Thorne, a non-executive director, said threatening the players had been a mistake.
The WRU executive leadership were very frustrated with the process and now understand that this was a mistake. The executive have apologised to the chair of the WRU and clearly accepts that this was an error. And there will be further conversations with the players in this regard.
Another independent review, this time into this latest affair, is due to be published, with some in the union saying heads could roll for what has been a turbulent time for Welsh rugby. Couple these incidents with poor results on the field in both the men's and women's senior team game, and the public and players could be forgiven for thinking that Welsh rugby is far from being a winning product.
Two silkscreen works by Andy Warhol have been stolen from an exhibition in the Netherlands. The thieves used explosives to break into the MPV gallery in Oosterwijk near Eindhoven. They made off with four pieces from a series called Reigning Queens. Among them, a portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. Two of the pictures were later found dumped in the street. Now for a first look at the morning papers. The Daily Telegraph reports that Elon Musk has attacked the Chancellor's budget announcement of an inheritance tax on some farmers' agricultural land. In a post on X, the world's richest man said, "We should leave the farmers alone." The paper says it can reveal that Labour MPs want the Treasury to consider raising the threshold at which the tax is applied after being inundated with calls from farming constituents. According to The Guardian, Donald Trump's team already appears to be preparing to challenge the result of the US presidential election if he loses next week. They're said to have filed a lawsuit in the key swing state of Pennsylvania alleging voter suppression. The front page of The Times is dominated by a photograph of the extraordinary, twisted mass of multiple ruined cars blocking that tunnel entrance in Valencia, bringing home the devastating effect of the catastrophic floods in Spain. And the Daily Mail and the Telegraph report that the King has ordered Prince Andrew's annual allowance, believed to be around £1 million, to be stopped. Both papers say details of the move emerged in a biography of the King by Robert Hardman, who writes that he's told the keeper of the Privy Purse to sever his brother's yearly payment. Hundreds of people in Dublin have fallen victim to what they fear was a Halloween prank. Details of a parade circulated online, promising spooky festivities in the city centre last night. Crowds took to the streets to be greeted by nothing, and they were left wondering whether their promised treat was actually a trick. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page has the story.
As Halloween night fell, crowds gathered on O'Connell Street, one of the major shopping thoroughfares in Dublin city centre. They'd been expecting to see a carnival parade, advertised to begin at 7 o'clock. The pavement was thick with people, but neither ghosts, witches, nor goblins materialised. With no pumpkins in sight, the police turned up to break the bad news.
There is no parade this evening. It was advertised on the fake website. Please disperse.
The size of the throng for a parade, which didn't happen, has led some to suggest that maybe the Irish capital should organise one. Gary Gannon is a Member of Parliament for the area.
Everybody was in really good spirits. Everybody was having fun. It does actually raise the question of, well, why isn't there an annual Halloween parade through Dublin? This is something that we could actually do very, very well.
The FIC event was originally listed on a website which gathers details of carnivals around the world. The supposed timing and location were widely shared on social media. The owner of the website, in Pakistan, has told the Irish Times that the listing was a genuine mistake rather than a deliberate hoax. No matter how it happened, online disinformation experts have said the story shows how easily people can be misled.
The headlines again. The number of people killed in devastating floods in eastern Spain has risen to at least 205. Emergency workers and soldiers continue to search for dozens of others who are missing. The government says it will announce further information for GPs after they warned that tax increases in the budget would force them to make staff redundant or even close down surgeries. 15 UN agencies have warned that about 400,000 people in northern Gaza are at imminent risk of death as the World Health Organization prepares to give children in the area a second dose of a polio vaccine. BBC News.
Presented by Tom Sanders. Now let's find out what's happening with the weather. Here's Darren Bett.
Hello there. Leaming in North Yorkshire was the place to be on Friday. There were 6 hours of sunshine here. But over the weekend, sunshine could be quite hard to find. We're expecting a lot of cloud around, a lot of dry weather too, and it's staying mild once again. Overnight, lows are going to be around 9 or 10 Celsius as we head into Saturday morning, and it's going to be a grey and gloomy start to the weekend. Extensive low cloud, some mist and some hill fog. There could be a little drizzle in the morning on Saturday across eastern parts of England and into Scotland. That should move away and the cloud may lift a little. The best chance of seeing some sunshine is going to be later in the afternoon in the far southeast of England, and probably a little earlier than that in the far northeast of Scotland. And for northern Scotland, it's going to be a milder day on Saturday than it was on Friday. Temperatures across the UK will again be 13 to 15 Celsius. High pressure is keeping things quiet and dry, but pretty cloudy. The centre of the high is going to drift further away from the UK, so there'll be a gentle southeasterly breeze as we head into Sunday. And that could introduce some slightly drier air as well. So perhaps a better chance of seeing some sunshine, that's more likely, across central and eastern parts of Scotland, maybe developing in northern England, North Wales, perhaps into the Midlands as well. But still large parts of the UK are going to be cloudy, overcast as well. The winds are going to be light, so that's not really stirring things up very much, but we're still in mild air, so temperatures are going to be up to 13 or 14 degrees on Sunday afternoon. Hopefully, we've got a better chance of seeing some sunshine, because as we head into the beginning of next week, whilst we've got high pressure close by, there's still going to be extensive cloud around, and particularly across England and Wales. Monday morning, Tuesday morning could see a lot of mist and fog, and that's going to be very slow to lift.
Thank you, Darren. Well, now we conclude this week's Book of the Week, Every Kind of People by Catherine Falk. Working as a home carer has introduced Kate to people from all backgrounds and walks of life. It's one of the many rewards of looking after others.
Sometimes I conduct little surveys among my customers. I call it question of the day. I once asked, what's the nearest you've ever come to total disaster and got away with it? The answers to that told me that everyone has a close call of some kind locked away with the skeletons in their closets. These near misses consisted mostly of lapses of memory that left babies in prams and laundry.